from the News Centre at 5. After 3 days of hearings, Oscar Pistorius has finally heard whether he'll be detained ahead of his murder trial. He claims he shot dead his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp, thinking she was an intruder. A magistrate in South Africa spent 2 hours running through legal arguments before the decision was made to grant the Paralympic athlete bail. Madupi Simaku is a National Prosecuting Authority spokesperson.
As the prosecution, we respect the judgment of the ruling of the court in terms of this bail application, and we would like to assure everyone that we are still confident of this case.
A court in Tenerife found a man guilty of murdering a British grandmother on the island. Jennifer Mills-Wesley, who is 16 from Norwich, was stabbed and beheaded in the resort of Los Cristianos in May 2011. One of the UK's largest catering firms is withdrawing all frozen beef products after some tested positive for horse meat. Sodexo supplies more than 2,000 outlets, including schools and care homes. Meanwhile, the Food Standards Agency revealed its latest test results, with them detecting no new cases of contamination. Andrew Rhodes is from the FSA.
The results we published today now account for 90% of the products that are available for sale in the UK. So we've made really, really good progress. We will continue to look until there is nothing left to find, and we will root out the cause of this problem, and those who are responsible will be dealt with.
Elsewhere, Birdseye removed 3 beef ready meals from shelves in the UK and Ireland as a precaution. It's after it found horse DNA inside a chili con carne it sells in Belgium. The BBC has published censored evidence about Jimmy Savile, some of it highly critical about its handling of the sex abuse scandal. Meanwhile, officials in Scarborough, where the star used to live, have stripped him of his title, the Freedom of the Borough. And soaring petrol prices means there's increasing pressure on the Chancellor to scrap a planned fuel duty rise. It's predicting record prices at the pumps. That's the latest. I'm Danny Crawshaw.
BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is the former Trades Union Socialist Coalition candidate for Bristol Mayor, Tom Baldwin. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Osborne's economy is sliding into the ditch. It's now clear none of his austerity measures are actually working. The ratings agencies are poised to downgrade Britain too. So this week, 2 expert guests, not official spokespeople, but with a proven independent mind, each of them. They'll take a warts and all look at Britain's finances and give their own version of Plan B, the plan we hope will be put in place before wages for all but the super rich are forced down even further and before we end up like Italy, Spain and poor old Greece. Well, they've had enough practice. The banksters are giving Europe and the US the same treatment they meted out to African developing countries over the last 40 years. Plus, Martin Summers' take on this week's weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute. First, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of -3. Ooh, pretty shivery, isn't it? And dry. This weekend, highs of 3 Celsius, a maximum. Pretty cold still. A fairly sunny weekend though. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, a cloudy week with some sunny spells, getting warmer though towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of March, highs of 6 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is former Trades Union and Socialist Coalition candidate for Bristol Mayor. That's Tom Baldwin. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, did I get that right? T-U-S-C,
yeah,
Tusk.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Now, just give us your impressions of the whole mayoral campaign, because you must have had a lot of hustings around the entire city over the space of several months.
Yeah, there was a lot going on, and they were quite well attended. I mean, there was at least 100 at each of those. But I think what was noticeable, first of all, was how shallow the discussions were with most of the candidates, because they weren't talking about the main issues, i.e. the council budget and how they're going to protect services. And there's a very clear reason for that. Most of them plan to go along with the cuts that the government was demanding. And I think as a consequence, so as a result, people were talking about themselves, people were talking about all different things, but not about the policies at hand. But as a result of that, there was an incredibly low turnout, particularly from the working class areas of the city. And I think a lot of people were thinking, well, none of this lot really stands for me, or none of the ones that I've heard of the main parties, certainly. So, you know, I think that was reflected in the fact that the vote was little over 10% in Hartcliffe, I think.
Now, also, the mainstream media and you know, us here on community radio, I hold my hands up. When we did our debate on this show back in November, you can't really get all of every single candidate around a table. I mean, how many of them were you altogether? Something like 12 altogether,
wasn't it?
15 candidates. Very, very difficult. Yeah. And also, if you're going to do a show on the radio like that, I mean, it may be possible to do on the television, but it's certainly on the radio, it's very difficult for anyone listening to actually distinguish who is actually speaking at any one time, make sense of a programme. So how did you feel that, do you feel that, you know, through those hustings that you actually got a fair crack of the whip? Because obviously, you know, for the mainstream press, we're mainly focusing on the candidates they thought were going to win. That is the sort of, you know, top estimated sort of 5 or 6 people.
Yeah, I mean, that's always something that we come up against as a new and relatively small party. Also, as a party of the left, as a group of socialists and trade unionists, then, you know, the mainstream media, particularly those owned by big business, have a vested interest in trying to keep what we're saying out and keep any kind of alternative to what's happening out of the spotlight. And we got better coverage for this campaign than other TUSC campaigns that have been in Bristol. But yeah, still some of the hustings, you know, did try and freeze out some of the smaller candidates.
Well, so the thing is, Tom, for many people, trade unionism is a thing of the past, that there isn't really an industrial heartland left in Britain anymore. And that the trade unions, that's where they were based, in industry and manufacturing, and now that's been stripped out, largely out of the economy. I mean, most of our manufacturing is imported from overseas now.
Well, and that's certainly true, although TUC unions do still represent 6 million workers in Britain, so they're certainly not a spent force.
I'm not sure how many political parties represent. I'm sure it's not 6 million. I mean, these political parties are around about 100,000 each, aren't they? So funnily enough, the trade unions are representing much more in terms of numbers of people than the political parties are nowadays.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think, you know, really, if you look at the trade unions, then the potential is there for them to play an absolutely key role in fighting back against the cuts. Because, it's the public sector where they're strongest, where the cuts are being directed. But it's not just public sector workers that are suffering from the cuts that are taking place. You know, everybody is losing out from this, unless you're some of the very wealthiest people in the country. And so the trade unions have the ability to bring people together and, you know, to hit the super rich where it hurts, really, hit them in the pocket by having workers come out on strike, withdraw their labour, and you know, hit the profits of these big businesses.
Well, that's the theory, but the fact of the matter is, often if workers do that nowadays, they're simply sacked. We had a case here in Bristol. I think it was at TV licensing, where a whole bunch of people went out on strike. The next day they were told, right, guys, well, we're going to close your office down. Then they moved those workers or those jobs either abroad or to another part of the country. So I think I'd like you to really answer the point I'm trying to make here, that trade unionism really doesn't have the industrial muscle it used to have.
At the moment, yeah, it's not as strong as it has been, but the potential is still there, and partly it's hemmed in by, you know, undemocratic laws that are aimed to restrict the action of unions, but, you know, those are only as strong as we let them be, really, and there's been instances with the prison officers, for example, where action's been taken that could be deemed illegal, but the government's not felt strong enough to take them on and take them to court. But I think, you know, in order to...
What's that about, for example? I mean, what are prison officers up to?
Well, prison officers are, you know, as with policemen, not entitled to strike. They have, you know, very little industrial rights or rights in the workplace. and so what this was, I believe it was over the prison privatisation programme, which will, you know, lead to the same kind of disasters we've seen in public transport, in the gas, the electric, stuff like that.
Well, the idea of people, private individuals making money as shareholders out of incarceration, I mean, it would lead to a US-style situation with, you know, vast proportions of the population in jail for profit.
Yeah, it would. And so last year, prison officers held meetings outside their workplaces, but it was essentially a walkout, and, you know, technically that could have been argued that that was illegal. But the, I mean, the point I was trying to make is the unions and working people, working class people, are strongest when we stand together, and not, you know, let this government pick us off one by one, basically. So, I mean, what, you know, what I would say is what's needed next is a one-day general strike, you know, to show the power of working people, to make this government tremble, and to show that we're not going to stand up for this. Now, you mentioned Greece.
Well, you are going to stand up for it.
Oh, sorry, yeah. We're not going to stand for this. Yeah, be more accurate.
Yeah, sorry. Now, the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, it sounds to me like a group of various different socialist-type organisations. Well, who are those different organisations?
Yeah, well,
I'm going to guess that one of them is the Socialist Workers' Party.
The Socialist Worker Party are part of it. I mean, I'm a member of the Socialist Party. They're also playing a role. But we also have the support in an official capacity of the Rail Union, well, Rail and Maritime Transport Workers Union, the RMT, leading figures in that, like Bob Crowe, like Alex Gordon, the Bristol-based former president, are very involved in that. But then, you know, there's also leading trade union militants from other unions in an individual capacity. And it's relatively small at the moment. It brings together a good group of people, but the potential is there for that to grow as well, particularly, as I say, people look at all the main parties and they don't see anyone representing them, so the need for an alternative is enormous.
So you're in the Socialist Party, but I have to put this to you, Tom. I mean, I don't think you're a Nazi, but Hitler was a socialist. The National Socialist Party in Nazi Germany rose to power, and it didn't look very nice when it was in power.
I would totally dispute the fact that Hitler was a socialist. Yes, he used the name socialist, but the nature of that organisation was totally different. And in fact, you know, on their rise to power, the Nazis had to smash the workers' movement physically, you know, break up trade union offices, attack genuine socialist organisations. And, you know, had they caught me, someone like me would have ended up in the concentration camps along with millions of others. So, no, I would dispute that had anything to do with socialism whatsoever.
Okay, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you're here too. Can you give us your take on this whole business of the trade union movement Tom's just been talking about there? Because I put it to you as well that trade unionism isn't what it used to be. And in the old days, of course, there were things like national strikes. There have been big coal strike, for example, that over several weeks brought the country to its knees. No power could be generated, this kind of thing. But those days are long gone.
Well, I mean, there's been a change in the balance of power in the labour market and in society at large, but that I totally agree with Tom, that doesn't mean that the trade unions are finished. People are suddenly realising, when you've got a kind of bosses government like the one we've got now and wages are being pushed down, that trade unions do have a purpose. And sadly, of course, people only realise that they need trade unions when it's too late. I mean, in other countries where they're better organised, like Norway, the trade unions are still very much in the driving seat.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I was at the offices of the National Union of Journalists earlier this week, and they had a massive postbag of membership applications from journalists at the BBC, because they were on strike on Monday. And I just happened to be down on the old picket line, 8 o'clock on outside the BBC on Monday morning, and I spoke to the Father of the Chapel, which is quite a quaint thing that they call the union organising within the BBC, a chapel.
Otherwise known as Daddy.
I don't know. I think the actual big boss is the Daddy. But anyway, that's Matthew Hill, who you see on Points West quite regularly, as the health correspondent on Points West, and I spoke to him on Monday.
I'm the Father of Chapel for Bristol's newsroom, Matthew Hill, and I'm here on strike today on the picket line to represent the NUJ, who are currently in dispute over compulsory job losses that are being made at various places, Asian Network, Five Live, Newsbeat. Not in Bristol, though.
So you're on strike even though no one's actually getting sacked here. Why is that?
Well, this is our national policy, and it's there as a deterrent, really, so that managers think carefully before they make people compulsory redundant. We believe there are members nationally who are willing to take voluntary redundancy in those places who are offering to come forward, but they're not being accepted as redundancies by the management. They want other individuals out.
Surely, I mean, you just have to take the hit. It is a recession, and many businesses have to make people redundant. That's just the way it is.
Well, it is a bad time. Yes, the licence fee is frozen. These are difficult times. But as I say, there are other people willing to take voluntary redundancy in those departments. So the savings can be made. It's just that they don't have to be compulsory. That's what the NUJ believe.
Well, is there any reason why they should single out specific people to be made redundant and keep others on? Surely they can just swap people around. Why do they do that?
I don't know. I mean, there's certain individuals that they want to be made redundant in those departments. But, I mean, if, for instance, those individuals are not up to the job, then they can be performance managed out, and that's part of the manager's job, to performance manage people out who are underperforming. So if that is the case, and I'm sure it's not, but if it is, then there is that sanction open.
Ultimately, though, how many people are BBC looking to sack?
The job loss is down. I think the latest was it was down to 30 that were across the board. I believe that it was about 30 that they're in dispute over. There's no Today programme on Today Breakfast News. There's only 7 till 7.30. There's going to be reduced service in the regions today, I would imagine.
How is what you're doing today actually going to make a difference?
Well, so far this policy that the NUJ have adopted has always made sure that this has not happened. We have not had compulsory redundancies, and so that's a policy which we are hoping will continue to be effective.
That's Matthew Hill there. He's the father of the chapel down at BBC Bristol. Tom, now one of the reasons that they're on strike on Monday is because they're concerned that the BBC are actually singling specific individuals out to be sacked, even though they could just simply swap people around, as they've done after the Jimmy Savile business. They've swapped managers around, moved them to various places without actually sacking them. But yet, when it comes to journalists, they'd rather single out specific individuals and remove them rather than do the opposite, which is just swap them around.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a consequence of, you know, not just the cuts at the BBC, but across the board, what's happening, the kind of change of culture that's being pushed by the government, you know, tax on employment tribunals, making people pay if they want to go to employment tribunal if they're unfairly sacked, tax on trade union organisation and other things, all of which gives the upper hand, if you like, to the bosses in order to bully individuals to think that they can fire at will and, you know, act as they please without any kind of accountability. You know, I know that's the case in a lot of private sector workplaces that aren't unionised at the moment, that the boss thinks they can act exactly as they please. And, you know, it's obviously the job of working people to stand together and to stand up for their own interests, as the workers at the BBC were doing there. I'll just make one final point, which is, you said that the NUJ office had a mailbag full of applications.
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily absolutely full, but quite a lot of applications from BBC staff at the moment.
I think that the point is, not only when people are feeling the pressure, but also when the union is making themselves relevant, when they're given a lead in terms of organising action and a fight back against what's happening, then people see their relevance and see that it's something for them to join. If all they're doing is saying, well, this is terrible, but there's nothing we can do, then I can understand people saying, well, you know, what's the point, really? So, yeah, I mean, the unions have to make themselves relevant.
Well, just to make it clear, I mean, it's all organised in a very democratic fashion. The reps from all over the country, from every single BBC site, all get together and make these decisions democratically. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this business of singling people out, though, I mean, this isn't the first time we've heard about this kind of thing at the BBC. Back in the 1980s, Mark Hollingsworth wrote a book called Blacklist, which showed that there were secret signs, a green Christmas tree printed on the personnel files of some BBC staff who had been singled out by an MI5 officer in the building to be sacked. So that's one of the reasons I think people are so sensitive about the idea of singling staff out.
Yes, and it was a Christmas tree, of course, because of the red flag is sung to the tune of "Oh Christmas Tree." So this was the implication of the Christmas tree on their files. Well, of course, journalists in particular, if they are being victimised for what they say or what they write, then in fact that's not just journalists who are suffering; it's the population at large that are being misinformed and basically misled. So, I mean, in not just in Britain, but in places like Egypt and so on, Tunisia, you know, the journalists are in the front row of of the fight for a democratic society, and that's true everywhere.
And one of the reasons the BBC are having to make this cut, supposedly anyway, is because of the freezing of the licence fee, which was, many people believe, was a deal done with the Conservative government, with Rupert Murdoch before the last general election, for Murdoch supporting the Tory party in the run-up to that election. So again, it sort of throws into relief, really, the way that these big, powerful media organisations operate, and that sometimes how the public sector, even in the press, is battling away with the private sector, Tom.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, like you say, it's not just in terms of the media, but it's across the board. The Tories have taken huge amounts of donations, for example, from private health firms, and those companies haven't given that out of the goodness of their heart. It's a, you know, it's a bribe, basically. They expect something in return, and that's exactly what we're getting, what they're getting, rather, in terms of the privatisation programme that this government's pushing through. Huge opportunities for profit for these companies. You know, same is true of the BBC. Someone like Murdoch has always opposed having a BBC because they see the potential advertising revenue if they can take over those channels and everything else.
Well, he says it's unfair competition.
Well, I don't agree with that. I mean, it's an impartial, supposedly. I mean, you know, the reality of that is obviously quite different. But it's publicly owned and supposedly impartial news service. I mean, you know, if you read The Sun, it's a piece of propaganda. You know, these are the personal views of Murdoch and of the class of people that he represents, the super rich. You know, I think having a BBC at least gives you some degree of balance on the telly.
But people want to laugh, that's why they buy The Sun.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would be a laugh if it wasn't so dangerous. I mean, you know, it's read mostly by working class people, but it's a very anti-working class paper. It turns people against each other. It tries to, you know, divide people, blame all kinds of people. It's a sexist paper. I mean, we may mention the Oscar Pistorius case later. Their take on that was a front page of the woman who was shot dead the night before in her bikini. I mean, the headline may have well have been, you know, this walking pair of breasts shot dead in South Africa. That's, as you know, the kind of extent that they treated her. And, you know, I could rant about the Sun.
Well, that's certainly not. I mean, that's certainly not. It's not treating the story with the dignity that it deserves.
I mean,
take your point.
You could open that paper every single day, and you could point to a similar example. I mean, you know, page 3 of the paper shows a topless woman daily, obviously. But it isn't that just that paper. I mean, you know, we talk about a freedom of press. There isn't a freedom of press in this country. You're only free to own a big media outlet if you can afford to buy it. So it's a freedom of press for billionaires, but for ordinary working people to get our point of view across is very difficult.
Well, we do it on community radio. Or on the internet or online. Okay, on to our first sort of proper story. Of course the BBC is a proper story. That was just a recording, but one of the mainstream press stories, deadlier than 7/7. Watch the moment the police foiled the terror bomb plot to kill thousands in the UK. Martin Summers, officers swooped on three Islamic extremists, Irfan Nasir, Irfan Khalid and Ashik Ali, who masterminded a suicide bomb plot bigger than the 7/7 atrocities. Now, this is the way it's being spun, but it wasn't actually, it didn't actually mature, this bomb plot, and there are still doubts over to what extent this Birmingham plot really was going to happen. So what's your take on this conviction of these three supposed terrorists from Birmingham?
Well, I mean, one point you would make is that there has been a jury and a proper trial here. This isn't Guantanamo, and that's the point, isn't it? I mean, if you want, you know, if you're going to convict people, you've got to do it properly, and you've got to do it on the basis of proper evidence and so on. I still suspect that an awful lot of these so-called Islamist terrorist groups are in fact being manipulated. So, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which they're supposedly connected with, the two guys that set that up were in Guantanamo, then released, then turned up in Yemen, and then started for organising Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And you'll see inside Libya, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group has been working with Western intelligence agencies for the last 30 years. Now, these young fellas may not know any of that. They may be classic patsies. So they've got involved, presuming that they're getting involved in Islamist terrorism, and in actual fact, they're being set up. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case. We don't know the detail. But one positive thing is that it's actually been done in a proper court of law in front of a jury. And, of course, later on, we'll be talking about secret trials and all the rest of it. Secret trials just doesn't cut the mustard, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, I did try and see if there had been any plea bargaining going on here, because this is another aspect of some of these trials, where the police say, well, you'll get a lesser sentence if you change your plea from not guilty to guilty. So I did try and find out if there was any of that went on in this trial. But ultimately, I mean, this is evidence, Tom, isn't it, that we do have a domestic terror threat here in Britain. It's just lucky it was in Birmingham this time, and MI5 and the police caught the people, not here in Bristol.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the phrase is that the police have to be lucky every time. The terrorists only have to be lucky on one occasion. I mean, obviously, it's good that this has been stopped. But, yeah, I think Martin's right. You know, if you look at the Justice and Security Bill, and kind of Orwellian name, really.
Well, that's right. I think that's absolutely right to talk about that in connection with this, because
that wasn't needed in this case. And, you know, it's very hard to see a case in which that kind of secret detention would be needed. The idea that they're doing this to defend democracy and everything else, well, actually, it's a huge undermining of a democratic society. It's having the government able to essentially abduct people in the middle of the night without giving reason, without even telling you what the crimes you are.
Well, in the Forest Gate, for example, shooting them as well. It's those sorts of examples which the attempt is to, you know, after one of these big trials and after one of these big events or, you know, activities by the police and security services, often information comes out which then enables people to sue MI5 and sue the police. And that is where this Justice and Security Bill comes in, Martin. It's been put forward by Ken Clark, who seems to be the only politician in the whole of Westminster who's prepared to defend it. And it means basically anything to do with national security is going to be heard behind closed doors, and those accused are not going to be allowed to know what they're being accused of or why the outcome is as it is. They'll just be told, you're going to jail.
Well, it sounds very like the Diplock courts in Northern Ireland, which had no juries, and of course lots of miscarriages of justice were carried out there. Incidentally, in the US, they've foiled any number of so-called bomb plots, but all of them, without exception, were FBI plots. So the FBI created the whole plot, supplied the explosives, then set these people up to do whatever it was, and arrested them at the last minute and said, oh, we've caught some terrorists here. But if you look at virtually every single case, and there have been scores of cases in the US, all of them FBI entrapment cases. And in actual fact, I'm not quite sure about this one, but you haven't looked, the detail hasn't come out yet. But of course, entrapment doesn't mean that you've actually caught any genuine terrorists. What you've done is set people up to look like terrorists and then sent them to prison for however long. But in actual fact, they would never have been terrorists if you hadn't actually pushed them and nudged them in the direction that you wanted them to go. And we've got a really a sinister kind of security state developing. And of course, secret courts are an absolute no-no. We can't have secret courts. The Magna Carta and all the rest of it goes back hundreds of years. Secret courts, no way.
Henry Porter wrote about this in The Observer on Sunday, the Justice and Security Bill. He says it's a chilling affront to British justice. And he says, as a Senator for Policy Studies book by the influential Conservative MP Andrew Tyrie and QC Anthony Pato explains, national security can be used to apply secrecy to cases that have nothing to do with torture and do not in reality jeopardise any national security at all. Closed material procedures, as they call them, could be ordered to limit legitimate protests, to hamper inquiries by investigative journalists, to prevent people from recovering property seized under the Proceeds of Crime Act, and to stop wounded servicemen from suing the Ministry of Defence for faulty equipment. Special advocates would be used to represent claimants who would never be allowed to know why their cases failed or succeeded. Tom?
Yeah, and that's a scary prospect, and the comparison with the Diplock courts, I think, is an accurate
one. What were these Diplock courts?
Well, it was, you know, as Martin said, basically secret tribunals used in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. You know, essentially, again, on a question of national security, or allegedly on that. But, you know, as Martin says, led to huge numbers of miscarriages of justice. Was a kind of political justice, really. If they were people that were seen as troublemakers, it was easy enough that this was a system that could be used to accuse them of something and put them down for it, regardless of the reality of that. I mean, another thing I'd say is, you know, a lot of, obviously, nobody wants a terror attack to occur. And so the idea of national security can be a way of making something like this, that is a terrible bill, trying to attach some popularity to it by saying it's for national security. But the definition of national security used by the government is far broader than what most people would. I mean, what they mean is basically protecting their system and protecting their own interests and those of the bosses. So I mean, the actor Ricky Tomlinson, in the 70s, he was one of the Shrewsbury pickets, people who were sent to prison for taking part in a strike. And the government has still, 40 years on, refused to release the files relating to that because they say it's a matter of national security. And it very clearly isn't. What it is a matter of is protecting the role of the police and probably the secret services as well, who basically stitched the Shrewsbury pickets up because they wanted to make an example of someone and they wanted to try and take on the trade union movement.
Well, that's particularly worrying because many of those police and security services individuals may have perjured themselves. If they've, you know, given false evidence, and then they're protected, which is really worrying. That is not justice. Martin, also, Amnesty International, Justice and Liberty and Reprieve have warned the threat of secret courts is graver than ever after the ministers defied the House of Lords and reverted back to the original version of this highly damaging justice and security bill. That was Amnesty International now.
Yeah, I mean, coming back to the original case that we were talking about, let's presume that these guys were guilty. I mean, there's been a jury, there's been a proper trial. Now, everybody in the Muslim community can see that if they were guilty, there's been proper evidence put forward, a jury's seen it, there's no cause for them to take offence at what's happening because it's all been done fairly and above board. Once you've got secret trials, you're in a situation, as in Northern Ireland, where people say, well, we don't trust your justice, and because we don't trust your justice, we're that much more inclined to pick up the bomb or the gun to make our political point, because you're not playing by the rules, so why the hell should we?
Another story this week, helping MI5 ruined my life. A man whose house was used as a spy base in an operation which scuppered the liquid airline bomb plot sues the Met for wrongful arrest. This was in the Daily Mail. Konstantinos Alexandros, who played a part in foiling the 2006 bomb plot, suing the Met police after claiming he was wrongfully arrested twice and falsely imprisoned. A man who helped MI5 and police convict the airline bomb plotters for conspiring to murder hundreds of people in an Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist attack, has described how his cooperation and its aftermath led to a series of incidents which have ruined his life. He basically allowed MI5 into his house, Martin, to use it for surveillance, and then he was shut out of it. He ended up, in fact, sleeping under the bushes outside the local police station because he couldn't get back into his house, even months after it had been taken over by MI5 for this surveillance operation.
Well, as you know, Tony, when I spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque some years ago, what I stressed to the people in there was that they shouldn't cooperate at all with the security services, because the security services, frankly, are suspects in many of these bomb cases.
Well, which is maybe why they want this justice and security bill.
Indeed, but that they should cooperate with local police officers that they know and trust, and only them. And that's the way we're going to get on top of this terrorist threat, much of which is, I'm absolutely convinced, rooted in the security services of NATO.
Tom, following his first arrest, Mr. Alexandros started sleeping rough, as I said, under the bushes outside Wood Green Police Station, as he didn't feel safe. His GP then made arrangements for him to stay in a night shelter. Well, it doesn't sound very nice, does it? I mean, he's cooperated with the security services to try and help them, and he's ended up sleeping under a bush outside a police station.
Yeah, I mean, I've only just seen the details of this, but yeah, I mean, you know, obviously they haven't done him any favours. I mean, if this is the way they treat someone that's supposed to have helped them out, then, you know, how can we trust them to treat anyone else fairly or even-handedly?
Or in the courts, in the Justice and Security Bill.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, on to another story, a local one this time. The mayor is plea for Bristolians to come together to save money. George Ferguson's launched a new scheme aimed at helping Bristol householders and small businesses, this is in the Post this week, to save money on their electricity and gas bills by joining together and switch energy providers. Bristol Switch and Save is a new not-for-profit collective buying scheme where residents and small businesses on a domestic tariff can join together to get a better deal, Martin.
Well, in principle, it's a good idea, I suppose. I mean, the problem is that all
of
this... You
sound a bit reluctant.
Well, because all of this switching and saving by everybody switching their providers, as you know, Tony, that we have the engagement what's known as confusion marketing. So it's very hard to work out what the lowest tariffs are. And in actual fact, we'd be much better off having a nationalised industry which actually produced at marginal cost, and which is what we used to do for many, many years, and it worked very well.
What do you mean by at marginal cost?
Well, basically, the instructions to a nationalised gas or electricity industry is to supply at cost. They're not there to make a profit, they're not there to make a loss, they're there to cover their costs, which means that your costs, your energy costs for your industry and so on, are that much lower. Once you privatise, you then have everybody trying to make a profit out of it, and they make a profit out of it by confusion marketing, as I've explained. You know, they basically make the tariffs so complicated that nobody can understand what's going on. And actually what you're doing is draining money out of the economy into the pockets of the super rich yet again, at the same time disabling your manufacturing industry, which has got to export. So, you know, basically we used to know these things. Most countries around the world, like Norway, for example, or Venezuela, they've just nationalised their oil industry and so on. Nationalisation is back on the agenda around the world, and it should never have been off the agenda. And no doubt we'll have to make some steps in that direction in this country eventually.
Tom, if you had been elected mayor, is this the sort of thing you'd have done?
Well, I think this is a very minimal thing. I mean, like Martin said, you can't really argue with it.
But I mean, in a way, he's sticking two fingers up to the national policy and the way that the electricity market works. He's saying we don't actually think that works. People in Bristol are going to get together, and they are actually going to play one electricity provider off against another.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that will have some effect, but it doesn't alter the fact that bills are rising far faster than wages are, that whichever company you're with, you're still stuck with unaffordable electricity bills. And, you know, for the mayor to think that you know, basically a kind of comparethemarket.com style scheme is
well, actually it's bristolswitchandsave.org.uk.
okay,
just,
well,
just to give the exact address,
you know, other compare the market things are available as well. But yeah, I mean, you know, this is a very minor thing, and, you know, it doesn't offset the fact that £35 million of services have been cut out of the city. You know, if he wants to improve Bristolians' lives, opposing that is you know, the main place to start, in my opinion. I've got no opposition to things like this, but I think it would be minimal for the reasons Martin gives, basically.
Okay, Ofgem this week, Martin, have been saying, watch out, everyone, because fuel prices are going, particularly gas and electricity, actually. Fuel prices for your home are going to go up again soon because of the international energy market.
Well, yes, and it's partly... as I've said on the show before, things like the oil price are not in any stretch of the imagination set in a free market. You've got things like the Organisation of Petroleum Exporting Countries, you've got the big oil companies, and so neither the oil price nor the interest rate are set by market forces. Those are the two most important prices in the so-called free market economy, which suggests to me that the free market economy doesn't exist and never has.
Yeah, so what do we do about it? I mean, surely what George Ferguson's doing here is exactly what we should be doing here in Bristol, which is coming together to really, to, like I say, play one provider off against another to get a better price.
There's nothing wrong with what's being proposed there, but it's fiddling while Rome burns. As Tom says, cutting £37 million this year out of the budget, that's not the end of it. This is far more important in terms of depressing the economy in Bristol and making life difficult for people than these fiddling while Rome burns tactics. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with this. The problem is that people are not serious, recognising the seriousness of the crisis. We can fiddle around by trying to improve things at the margin, or we can go to the heart of the matter, which is the central government's cuts policy, which is wrong.
George Ferguson doesn't control the central government's policy. So, you know, surely this is the least he can do is this.
Yes, but what he also should be doing is lining up with all the other major cities and saying the policy itself is wrong, and not just saying, oh, well, we've got to implement it. Maybe you have got to implement it. That's possibly where Tom and I would disagree. But at the same time, even if you're implementing it, you've got to, what we're really looking for is to get this government out. So elections in Bristol to elect the mayor were part of a cup final run to London. And that's what George doesn't seem to get. He wants to talk about Bristol all the time, and it isn't just about Bristol. Most of the things that affect people in Bristol are not Bristol specific. They are national problems. And that's what, and that you could argue that there's not much point having local government at all these days, because they haven't actually got any fundraising powers, and they've actually got to do pretty much what central government says. So we have a whole silly argument about whether we're going to have a mayor, then we decide we're going to have one, then we elect one on a minority of the vote, and then they've got to do what central government wants anyway. This is farcical, frankly.
Next story. The families can be better off on benefits than in work, says Bristol City Council run advice line. This is, I think, a slightly pernicious story here from the Post, running along a sort of conservative line. But I mean, it is true, isn't it, that sometimes, Tom, particularly if it's very, very small numbers of hours, that it, at least this is what this advice line is saying, that sometimes it can actually cost you to take a small job, which is only a few hours. If a person, I'm just quoting someone from the advice line, a person took a job for just a few hours a week, they could end up being slightly financially worse off than being on benefits.
No, I've no doubt that that can be true. And part of the problem is that for a lot of people, the only jobs that are available are those very very few hours and very low paying jobs. And you know, I think that's the problem. And the way that the Post has spun it a bit, you know, certainly the way that the government would spin it is, well, this shows just how generous benefits are, and you know, people would rather stay at home scrounging. And the truth is, you've got people that want to work but aren't able to because the jobs aren't there. But also, the main thing about this is it doesn't show how generous benefits are. It shows how appalling wages are for people. I mean, you know, wages have risen far slower than prices for a number of years. And, you know, even for people in work, it's very, very hard to make ends meet. And
but I think Tom, isn't one of the big reasons for that immigration? The fact that there's so many migrant workers now in Britain that have forced wages down. Employers have been able to pick and choose the lowest person will accept the lowest wages, and so that's one of the things that's driven down. You know, the for the majority of people, the general wages, it's all driven by immigration.
I wouldn't say that's the primary cause of it. I mean, it is true that bosses will try and use any means they can to drive down wages, you know, particularly if there's a way of splitting workers and splitting people against each other. But I mean, you know, if you look since the start of the crisis, then you know, wages have been held virtually stagnant in the last kind of 4 or 5 years. That's nothing to do with migration. That is to do with you know, basically bosses using the excuse of this crisis in order to tighten the belts on the wage bill and pocket more of the difference for themselves in terms of profits. If you look at countries like Greece or Spain, for example, I know a lot of Spanish people I know have moved now to Bristol because the work isn't there in Spain. There's a huge exodus of young people from those countries because the work isn't there, but still the wages are being pushed down. And so, you know, the argument, you know, that's a kind of counter argument, really, because, you know, there's net migration from the country rather than immigration, and still the problem of falling wages exists.
Martin, ultimately, I'm better off on benefits than in work.
Well, ultimately, what we're going to have to do is what the Greens have been talking about for a very long time, which is introduce a citizen's income. So, in other words, this person who's got children and wants to work a few hours a week, they shouldn't lose a penny of benefit if they take a 5 hours a week job. Why not? And of course, you would say, well, you can't just pay everybody to be a citizen. And he says, yes, you can. It was actually Milton Friedman who put forward this idea originally in the 1960s. It's been costed out. In Denmark, they nearly brought it in the 90s. But then, of course, the neoliberal counter-revolution set in. But before this crisis is over, we're going to remake the economy so it serves people rather than profit. And one way we'll do that is by giving people unconditional benefits, which they can then work on top of if they want, or if they want to just stay at home and look after their kids, that will be fine as well, because we want to live in a better society, and that's what it's all about.
Bristol has the highest child poverty figures in the southwest. Another story from the Post by Tom Morris this week. A quarter of all children in Bristol are now living in poverty. More children in the city live in poverty than any other part of southwest England, with Torbay at 22%, Plymouth 21%, Gloucester at 19%. A child in poverty is defined as living in a household where the income is below 60% of the average household income, which stands at £360 a week. This is pretty horrific, isn't it, Martin? Highest poverty figures in the southwest are here in Bristol. The Peter Townsend from Child Poverty Action Group says individuals, families and groups in the population can be said to be in poverty when they lack the resources to obtain the types of diet and participate in activities and have the living conditions and amenities which are customary or at least encouraged and approved in the societies in which they belong. This is the sharp end of the cuts, isn't it?
It is, and we're going to see these figures worsen as the crisis deepens and the government carries on ploughing the car into the ditch. And there's always been a huge problem with this in Britain, but of course over the last few years, with the concentration of wealth and income at the top and the squeezing of people at the bottom, the problems get worse. And of course, children, you're blighting their whole life chances by giving them no decent...
Well, this is
no
the actual figures for Bristol given by Child Poverty Action Group are 29% of children in the city are now living in poverty, Tom.
Well, it's 29% in Bristol South. It's a quarter across the city. But, I mean, you know, in any case, these are shocking figures. And, you know, we're not just dealing with relative poverty, bad as that is. But if you see the news, for example, a few days ago about the UN's comment on the number of food banks in Britain, which is rising sharply, we're dealing with absolute poverty. People that aren't even able to feed themselves daily. More than 80% of teachers say they see kids that come in that haven't had breakfast. And these are shocking figures. This is the real impact of what's happening. Not just the government's decisions in terms of cutting services and everything else. How that's being passed on by local authorities. For example, one of the things that George Ferguson's cut in his latest budget is children's centres attached to schools, which play a whole number of different roles in child protection, kind of caring for children. That's going to impact on this. But also how that culture of attacking ordinary people and acting in the interests of the bosses has freed the hand, as I've said, of a lot of businesses to, you know, hold down or drive down wages and everything else.
Martin, the right to an adequate diet is required under the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Mr. De Schutter, who's from the United Nations, told The Independent, "What I looked at in Canada and what I shall commence upon in the UK is the idea that governments have a responsibility in ensuring adequate diets, and that's not happening here in Britain." This is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food.
Well, that's right, and it's in Britain, but it's also across the developed world. We're seeing attacks upon people's traditional living standards, which were low enough anyway in many places. And, of course, what really people need to get their heads around is that this is economically irrational. Cutting the benefits and the wages of the lowest people at the bottom does nothing to rebuild the economy. Nothing at all. What we actually need is increased wages and increased benefits.
Another story kind of on the other side of the coin. I was one of the lucky few to get a job at Costa. A worker picked from 1,700 applicants for just 8 jobs. At a new coffee shop, an average of 212 applications for each individual post at this branch of Costa, which opened in Nottingham, Tom. Just 3 of the jobs, with wages from £5.40 to £10 an hour, were full-time. So most of these were just part-time jobs. Many applicants have been made redundant by HMV or Clinton cards, and rejected applicants had more than 15 years experience in retail. So, I mean, it's just applying for a job in Nottingham at Costa is like banging your head against a brick wall.
Yeah, I mean, this gives the lie to the government's idea that people who are out of work are lazy, work shy, and essentially are there through their own volition. I mean, you know, a few weeks ago, what was it, 3,000-4,000 HMV workers, according to the government, would overnight have taken the decision that they'd rather stay in bed than go to work. And that's obviously not the case. The company's gone into administration. This is the truth of it, that finding the work isn't easy. And we're not talking here about, you know, a well-paid post. We're talking about probably little over minimum wage working in retail. We're talking not even of a full-time job. And yet this is the desperation for people to get it. And that gives the whip hand to the boss in this case, because they can handpick who they want, but they can also say to people when pay rise comes around and they're getting 0%, well, thank your lucky stars that you're not out of work. I could find, 212 people to come and apply for your job, and, you know, that is used to kind of cow people and to try and, attack people's living standards further, basically.
Well, Martin, what are your thoughts about this incredible number of applications for just a handful of jobs at Costa Coffee in Nottingham?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because what we've seen, and a lot of economists are trying to understand this, because the British economy is dead in the water, but it still seems to be creating some jobs. Now, I think partly that is to do with the fact, as we now find out, that people on work placements and so on are being counted as employed. So it's the usual, we're fixing the figures scenario.
Well, there's another big aspect to that, and that is a very good investigation that was done by Five Live, BBC, about people who are being shifted off of unemployment benefit and job seekers allowance onto tax credits, yeah, and being told, well, you've got a year and a half or so to make a success of a business as a self-employed person. We'll give you a little while. But, of course, as you're doing that little experiment, maybe working just a few hours a week, maybe hardly any hours a week, you are then claiming tax credits rather than job seekers allowance. You don't have to sign on or anything like that. So, but you're off the figures. The main thing is you're off the figures, and you're on to the figures that the government can wave around and say, oh, look, these people have got jobs, even though they haven't.
That's right. And I think also the labour market in Britain functions rather differently than it did in the past, which is a lot of the strain is taken by wage cuts rather than sackings, as it used to be the case. And of course, the problem with that is it still doesn't provide demand in the economy. What we really need to see is increasing wages so that people have got money to spend to get the economy moving. And of course, the other thing is that because the economy is dead in the water and unemployment is still supposedly falling, that means that productivity per worker must be going down. So the quality of these jobs is rubbish. You know, what we really want is high quality jobs that pay high levels of wages, which allow the economy to function. If everybody's just doing scrappy little jobs, that is not actually what you want. You see, in Scandinavia, they try and get rid of scrappy little jobs. They don't say, oh, a scrappy little job is better than no job. They say, no, we're not interested in scrappy little jobs. We're only interested in high pay.
I mean, is it fair to say that back in the 1980s, the Conservative government then really destroyed much of the manufacturing industry? Things like the steel industry was massively cut back. Now it's the service sector which seems to be under the hammer.
Yeah, well, the point about manufacturing, of course, is that relatively low-skilled people can earn very relatively high wages because productivity increases in manufacturing pretty automatically through new technology and so on, although that then creates a problem of technological unemployment. But service industries, you can't really increase productivity much. You know, if you are providing something like a haircut, you can't really improve the productivity of haircutting very, very much. Whereas, of course, if you're building cars, then, of course, the productivity will rise as you get better technique for building cars.
In fact, you could probably even have a factory with only five or six people in it, machines
make. That is another problem. But the point is that the manufacturing allowed wages to rise in line with productivity, which meant that basically people could buy back the stuff they produced and the economy functioned reasonably well during that era. The whole thing of driving wages down, which has been the kind of holy grail of conservative and some labour policy as well to some extent, is that eventually you just end up poor. And that, in fact, is not what you want. And if you look across the North Sea to Norway, you'll see that people who are working in bars there get paid an awful lot more than they get paid over here.
OK, at the other end of the scale, anger this week over £1 million pay deals for rail bosses as fares keep going up. This is Kevin Rawlinson in The Independent, I think. This is rail bosses being handed pay packets worth as much as £1.4 million, while commuters are being hit with rising ticket prices. Now, this is all the results of a Freedom of Information request. Executives at Go Ahead, First Group and Network Rail were getting deals worth more than £1 million when assorted bonuses and other benefits were taken into account. Meanwhile, a passenger satisfaction survey published today by Consumer Magazine, which, that was Monday this week, shows that more than half the companies running Britain's train network were given scores of less than 50% satisfaction. Research showed only 22% of train users felt the service they received was improving, despite rising ticket prices. It was revealed last month that ScotRail boss Stephen Montgomery received a £54,000 pay rise, taking his salary up to £333,000 in 2012. The company is owned by First Group, remember them? Our local train firm, and bus firm, of course, where Chief Executive Tim O'Toole was paid, £846,000 last year, plus £134,000 pension contribution and £75,000 as benefits in kind. And I can't what those benefits in kind are. Gifts?
Lots of train
expensive
journeys.
Sports cars? I don't know. Accounts showed that in the year ending March 2012, First Group made an operating profit of £110 million on its UK rail business. So what does this tell us about privatisation, Tom?
Well, I don't think this has come as a huge surprise to a lot of people, actually, and certainly anyone that's been on the rail. And, you know, these private firms are in it for what they can get for themselves.
And also the passengers. I mean, if you go on one of these services, you often find passengers chit-chatting to each other about just how diabolical the service is.
Yeah.
There's a sort of hatred for the actual providers of the service, even though they have to use it.
Yeah. I mean, the real shock of that story is probably that 50% of people have deemed it satisfactory rather than anything else. And, you know, with an appalling service, there's more taxpayers' money goes into the train system now that it's a series of private companies than it did when it was British Rail, because then the money that was made on tickets came back to help run the service. Now those subsidies go directly into the pockets of these big companies, of their shareholders, and of course their top bosses are getting a chunk of that. I believe it's also the case that with one of the I think it's the East Coast Main Line, and you know the fiasco that surrounded that a couple of years ago, that is now in public hands, but still the boss of it is getting a huge wage and a huge bonus. So I think, you know, what one point coming out of that is we need not just to own these companies, but we also need workers' control of nationalised companies in order that, you know, ordinary people can have a say over how they're run, so we can rein in bosses. There's no reason for them to be on this huge amount of money, you know, so separate from those people.
Martin, the same is true in the banking system, isn't it, with RBS and Lloyds. They're very, very well paid. But, I mean, Tim O'Toole, this is the First Group Chief Executive, his remuneration package was worth more than £1 million last year. The American executive, that's because he is an American, left a lucrative job with London Underground, where he earned a CBE for his response to the London bombings. He left there to join First Group, but he's on £1 million.
Well, in fact, bankers would regard £1 million as a piddling wage. And no doubt you see Mr. O'Toole and all these other people working in the railways, they compare themselves with their chums that they meet at the golf club who are bankers. And of course, this sort of money, that, you know, they're embarrassed to say that they've only had an £846,000.
But there's something gone very, very wrong here, isn't it? Some people who are able to control wages are giving themselves fantastic amounts of money whilst they're asking the people at the bottom of the ladder to simply take pay cuts. Something's wrong.
Yeah, well, if you actually look at the ratio of what shop floor workers earn to managers in Japan, it's still within some kind of reasonable relationship, but in the US I believe it's hundreds of times more. And all of this happened in the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, most European most developed countries, that the gap between shop floor workers and managers, and in Japan they've had a deliberate policy of squeezing that. I mean, in actual fact, if you can get top managers at a fraction of the money, then that's what you should do. I mean, that's what you do on the shop floor. You don't overpay, and we shouldn't be overpaying managers. What's happened is a culture of overpayment at the top, where everybody compares themselves to their other chums, and they're all, of course, basically, you know, they're not doing the job properly and they're being overpaid for it.
Well, for many people in the city are dependent on benefits, including now a majority of people who are actually working also need benefits too. There is a new leaflet now which drops through my letterbox this week called Benefits Briefing. Tax credits and benefits are changing, so it's important be prepared and check that you're getting your correct entitlement now. Major changes to the welfare system have already started, with many more to follow. And this is really talking about the changes that are coming at any time now to the benefit system, so maybe it's not the best time to be changing everything. But anyway, thank you very much this week. That's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, former Trade Union Socialist Coalition candidate for Bristol Mayor, Tom Baldwin. After the news, Plan B.
Thank you.
At bcfm.org.uk. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live.